So yes, as was pointed out, I'm one of the few people at this table that doesn't remember that Yom Kippur in 1973. And my thought here was I wanted to make sure that we like acknowledge something about it, have a chance to look back at something about the Yom Kippur War. My thought is not to really do the history and the battle plans and who was at fault and whether they should have been a preemptive attack or whether there shouldn't have been or those kinds of things. I did want to just take a look at what was the religious reaction at the time. There was a religious Zionist community at the time, and how did they put the war in context? Like immediately after, I mean, it's not so long ago, right? The rabbi had to speak that morning on Yom Kippur, either knowing or maybe not knowing, right? And in the weeks followed. So what was the reaction? How was it put in the context? So you can't really think about the Yom Kippur War without thinking about what happened 6 years earlier in the 67 War. And in some ways, they were opposites of one another. The 67 War were days of dread and fear leading up to it, and all of a sudden, there was immediate exultation. Right? On the other hand, the Yom Kippur War were leading up to it in terms of being confident and everything is fine and they wouldn't dare attack us and how could they possibly do it? And you were left with, oh boy, this is not going to be that all of a sudden things are put in its place. So I did get over the summer the journal called Tradition, so it came out, had about 7 or 8 articles on the topic. It really was able to focus on 2. So one of them was Rav Yehuda Amital, which is actually a translation. Rav Yehuda Amital was the Rosh Yeshiva of Har Etzion back in the day, along with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And the Har Etzion, I'm not sure if they lost more than other Hezder yeshivas, but they did lose 8. There were 8 Talmidim that were killed very early on. I think they might have already been at the line. I mean, I think they might have been killed on the first day. I mean, they weren't in yeshiva. They were in their part of the Hezder program. And that day, as news got in of what was going on, there were immediately guys that had to leave in order to get called up. And they were called up that day. In fact, in his biography, they record that those guys that were being called up, so they daven ne'ilah early. I mean, they daven mincha quickly, they daven ne'ilah early, and then they got out of there. And then as the fast came to a close, so he told everybody else, if you have units, just go. You're not like, don't wait to be called on, just get out of here, go. The yeshiva anyways was going on Bein Hazmanim at that point, and the yeshiva cleared out. Now, again, 8 students were killed, several others were wounded very, very badly, and this actually impacted him in a very significant way, also in terms of his hashkafa and politics for years to follow. But he had an interview that he gave to a newspaper right after the war was over. The war lasted a couple of weeks. Pretty soon after that, he gave an interview, which they translated and put out now, along with footnotes and made nice. So we'll discuss that a little bit. And then also, Rabbi Tzvi Sinensky, who lives locally, he lives in Bala. He was my neighbor in the Beis Medrash for many years. He also happened to marry Rabbi Lamb's granddaughter and has been putting a lot of work in going back into Rabbi Lamb's drushos and writings and speeches. So all of Rabbi Lamb's sermons, I shouldn't say all, many of them are actually available online. There's something called the Yad Lamb. You could track it down. They're not the easiest thing to locate, but they're all PDFs of his type things. My father's company actually put them out originally. They were the one that my father said that they were collected in the YU library, the typed copies, along with like the crossouts and the whiteouts and all that kind of stuff, and even where he wrote things in. He said the dean of the library came in one day to his office with 4 boxes of papers, and he put it on the internet originally. That's what his business does. So that's available. So you can actually track down by year and see, like, figure out what happened, what was happening in the world, and what did the rabbi speak about the Shabbos immediately afterwards, which is always a fascinating thing. Rabbi Lamb gave hard musser, by the way. He gave, he spoke in ways that I don't think rabbis today could get away with somehow. So I just wanted to share a couple. So those are sort of the 2 sources that we that I put together for some of these discussions. So number one, this is not the right page. There we go. Okay. So, first of all, you could sense from Rav Amital's discussion that there was a lot of blame going around. This was immediately afterwards. And there was, and you know, whether the government, people claim that the government's arrogance or the military's arrogance has led to this. They quoted the psukim that we've read over the last couple of weeks in Devarim about when you go into the land, don't be satiated, don't just be happy, you know, like you're going to have to continue to fight. And he said that people said that the victory in 67 was kochem va'otzem yadi, was the strength of our arms, and they sort of lost track of the challenge and desperation that Israel called for. So he sort of put a stop to that and said, you know, whenever we talk about blame and spiritual meaning, if it's a physical blame, meaning if something led to another, so okay, that's one thing. But whenever it deals with, you know, a cheshbon hanefesh, some kind, and this is something that shows up regularly, oh, the reason this is happening is because they violate that or they did that. So he said, you always have to point the finger at yourself. And if they go ahead and say that this is a spiritual challenge and it's their fault, right? They're not doing the right thing. So that's always going to be an issue. So that's one thing that he discusses. Another thing that I think the bulk of what he was trying to drive at is, we discussed this in the Yeshayahu shir in the last one that we gave. And that is that the Geula is described in two different ways. The Geula, the redemption, is described as something that's great and powerful and that everybody, the whole world, will go and see. But it's also described as a man riding into town on a donkey. Right? So how do you put the two of those together? So the Gemara itself asks that question, and the Gemara responds by saying one of them is a Geula that is not at the right time, meaning we earned it ahead of time. So if we earn it ahead of time, so then it's going to be clear for everyone to see. But there's also a Geula that is being caused because the time came, and sort of Hashem has no choice but to like bring the Geula, right? It just has to happen. So he says that's when things are going to be challenging. And when the term Aschalt de Geula, right, the beginning of the redemption, so that means that it's the beginning, and that means that there will be challenges up ahead. So even though we just experienced this euphoric victory, it doesn't mean that there are no longer going to be challenges. The chiyuv, the obligation about davening during an eis tzara, of doing things when there is a difficult time, making sure that we are constantly doing a cheshbon hanefesh, so that obligation is still required even during the time of Mashiach. I mean, the zman of Mashiach might be now, he's not denying that, but the idea that it's the beginning and not it means that it's a challenge, and this is then this needs to then be put into the context of being part of the challenge, right? To rise and to fall. So there will be falls, there will be difficulties along the way. Another thing he said is, and sort of the third aspect of what he discussed is the idea of gratitude. That in the immediate aftermath, right, everybody got sort of beat up, and everyone really felt bad about what was going on. But he says, and the victories that were seen, meaning Israel's Six-Day War victory was, you know, gutsy and brilliant, but like you can understand what happened. The war, some of the victories that took place during the Yom Kippur War were mamish, like one tank holding off 100. Like, I mean, the Syrians had marched in, and Tveria was right in front of them. I was just listening to history, and they decided, you know what, it's probably an ambush, it's probably a trap, we're going to hold off here. And the day that they waited to make sure it wasn't a trap, so all of a sudden they showed up and they were able to defend the Tveria. But like they could have not been able to. Right? There were many aspects of the victory that he thinks probably more than the previous battles, the previous wars that Israel had fought, can only be attributed to a miracle min hashemayim, an is min hashemayim, and divine protection. So that requires gratitude. And there is a Gemara in the Seches Brachos that discusses that when a person a person hears about the death of a loved one, so they say the bracha of Baruch Tayyim Ha'emet, but also there's also perhaps a Shehech Yanu aspect to it, and that they get an inheritance. Now, whether we'd say that or not, Bisman is that it's not, but there is two sides to the coin. That's what he is invoking. That yes, we mourn the dead, and it was challenging, and we reassess, and we etc., but we also still need to have that Hakara Satov, the gratitude for the outcome that came from it. And then he pointed out one more, and I sort of appreciated this luck. He said there is a Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin that says that somebody who died, somebody who was killed Ayidei Malchus, meaning by the non-Jewish government. So they get executed by the non-Jewish government. So the Gemara records, says a statement saying, we're not masped them. We don't give eulogies for them. Meaning somebody, it sounds like they're executed for being Jewish, and we don't give them a eulogy. So the question is why? So most Rishonim on that page say, give reasons because like it's a practical idea. Meaning we can't do it because, first of all, if they're killing this guy, that means that the Jewish people in general are in trouble right now, and it's an Eitz Tzar, it's a difficult time for us to get together, is just itself going to be dangerous. Or, the king is giving us permission to bury him now, but who knows if he's going to withdraw that permission. So let's just bury him, and we're not going to worry about eulogies. That's the way most Rishonim understand it, with the explanation being that if those factors are not present, then it would be permissible. So all of that. So that's with the exception of the Ramban. The Ramban on that Gemara, and the Ramban is quoted in the Beis Yosef. The Ramban says that no, it's a rule. It's just a rule that is the rule. If somebody dies, sounds like at battle or from another from a non-Jewish government, we don't give a hesped. So he doesn't really explain himself why. At least in the Beis Yosef, it's not quoted. The Ramban wrote a sefer called the Torah Ha'adam, which is all his laws of Avelis. So it's quoted as being there. It's 200 pages long. It's very hard to find anything because it's like sort of have to know the whole book in order to find anything. So I wasn't able to look it up inside. So I don't know if he gives a reason inside. But Rav Amital said, he said, now I understand that Ramban. He says, because if during a time like this, so there were over 2,500 at least Jews that were soldiers that were killed. So to go ahead and give Hespedim for each one, he said, I had to do it. I mean, I had to be maspid eight of my Talmidim. And to go and to do that one after another, that act itself is going to be an act of despair. Right? That itself is going to then cause a loss of morale. And since that's probably what the Ramban meant. I mean, for us to go and be maspid people when it's a situation like that is a problem. But he points out, we don't paskin like that Ramban. he says, I'm also thankful that I appreciate what his perspective is, but I'm also appreciative of the fact that we don't assume that way. Because we go ahead and still have to recognize the individuals that were lost, and that's what we do. We say that's what we did. Meaning we did do that appropriately, but I also recognize the impact that it potentially could have. Like you hear him like sort of riding this ridge, trying to like, you know, it's a national thing, but it's also an individual thing, and somehow have to measure that out. He said he was speaking with one of his rebbeim in the yeshiva paid a shiva call to one of the parents that were, actually this is more on the previous section of having some hakaras hatov. He said he paid a shiva call to one of the parents who were sitting shiva for their son, and the father said to him, he says, look, I'm a survivor. I lost my wife and five children during the Holocaust. He died defending the Jewish people. I think we're making some progress. I mean, at least we're in a better spot on behalf of that. And that's part of what he then also discusses. He discusses that part and parcel with Mashiach is going to be war. I mean, that is sort of the problem. When the Rambam records what the Messianic period is going to be, okay, he says that who's going to be the Mashiach? The Mashiach is going to be the one who claims Malchus, claims the kingdom, destroys Israel's enemies, and then rebuilds the Beis HaMikdash. Unclear whether it has to be in that order or not, but that's part of it. Part of it is the war, and part of it, and not just is it a war, but it's described in the prophecies as a war that the whole world will be involved in. Not necessarily that the whole world, not necessarily a world war, but that it's something whose impact will be felt throughout the entire world. So you have to recognize that. That's part of A, it's part of the process. B, we were told it's going to be. It's part of the clarification that is necessary for the war. Be thankful for what we have, and recognize that we were able to achieve some amount of salvation, be saved, and then save the keep those ideas in mind going forward. Just one or two thoughts that Rabbi Lam pointed out. Rabbi Lam A spoke right away, right after. On Sukkot, meaning Yom Kippur happens, and then Sukkot is a couple days later. So nobody really knows what's going on at that point either. In fact, I read today that Dayan was ready to speak and talk about how we've lost territory and a lot of soldiers. They think he may have had a nervous breakdown during that time, and whoever his aide was called. Golda Meir and said, like, you can't let him speak. Like, that can't happen. And she barred him from the radio at that point. But it was nobody quite knew, even a couple of days after Yom Kippur, what exactly was going on. So he was asked, so what do we do? Sukkot is Zman Simchasenu, and we have Simchas Torah coming up. Like, do we cancel it? Like, what do we do at that point? And he said, no, that there is still an idea of maintaining simcha. I remember in my own life, I think there were several, during the Intifada, there were several bombings, like big bombings right before Purim one year, like Erev Purim, or day two before Purim. I remember being in yeshiva, like, are we having a chagiga tonight? Not? Like, what's happening? You know, and it was somewhat subdued, and like that tension is important to keep in mind. And he also put into and then a couple of months later he went to Israel in the aftermath of the war. He went twice, he talks about, and he actually put in context the two wars, both during the Six-Day War as well as this one, in the context of in the context of two major chatayim, two major sins of that we sort of point to in our history. So the sin of selling Yosef, right? What's the sin of selling Yosef? So that was the brothers getting together and saying, you know, who needs this guy? He says that was a sin of arrogance. The sin of the chita egel, of the golden calf, that was a sin of despair. Oh, what's going to be? We don't need, you know, Moshe's not around. What's going to be? So he said that perhaps we were guilty before the Six-Day War of having too much despair, of being too low. No, during the Six-Day War, it was about being too low. And perhaps this was a sin of being too high. I mean, before the Six-Day War, we were we didn't think, you know, what's going to be? We got to get out of here. And during and this was perhaps a sin of being too arrogant. And we have to figure out, find the middle line between those two. Recognize that, you know, we have Kadosh Baruch Hu with us. He's helped us in the past. He'll help us in the future. But also recognize that we can't just rest on that. We need to constantly be striving, both spiritually and physically, to make sure that we're in a good spot. So that just a couple thoughts that I put out there in terms of the Torah response. I did also read a little bit about how all of a sudden the anti-Zionists, as soon as that Yom Kippur became Zionists all of a sudden, I mean, even those that were fighting against those types of sects, it's like, no, that's we're against the state. But if there are Jews in danger, so then we're ready to go and defend the Jewish people and do whatever it takes. So there's that aspect, meaning they fought against, in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, there was in ways, the Satmar sect and things like that, in a way they stepped up their thing. I mean, they said to celebrate this is a, you know, it's Satan that brought this upon us, and therefore we have to, like, fight more against it. They doubled down on their anti-Zionism. But during this time, it was, well, we got to do whatever it takes and call whatever connections we have in order to make sure that we could save Jews however possible. So sort of putting those two in context with one another, and, you know, Baruch Hashem, in the time since then, Israel has not had to fight a major war against another country in the way that those took place, and hopefully we'll follow the path and hopefully lead ultimately to a time of ultimate shalom. Yeah.
Obviously, it's more started than Yom Kippur, but I can't recall.